Hey bosses, before we kick off this episode, I want to tell you about our sponsor this week, Nom Nom. Your pet's a member of the family. Don't feed them like they're in the doghouse. Give them Nom Nom. Nom Nom delivers fresh dog food with every portion personalized to your dog's needs so you can bring out their best. Nom Nom is made with real whole food you can see and recognize. No additives or fillers that contribute to bloating and low energy. Nom Nom uses the latest science and insights to make real good food for dogs. In fact, they've already delivered over 40 million meals to good dogs like yours, inspiring millions of clean bowls and tail wags. You can check out Nom Nom right now for 50% off. You get a no-risk two-week trial when you go to trynom.com/ilab. That's trynom.com/ilab. trynom.com/ilab. You're going to get 50% off a two-week trial. I'll tell you even more about Nom Nom in a minute. But for now, let's kick off this episode of Invest Like a Boss.
Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
I'm Derek Spartz.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Invest Like a Boss, brought to you from the mountains of Andorra, or was. Sam, welcome to the show.
I was like, wait a second, you're in Andorra? That's so weird, man. I was there 3 days ago.
How crazy it would be if we just both happened to be in Andorra, we just missed each other.
I know a lot of people are listening to this saying, where's Andorra? And the few people that I've talked to when I was there, they're like, everyone thinks it's in Africa.
Yeah, is it not?
No, it's in this tiny little country smudged in between Spain and France.
Oh, so that was an easy trip for you then.
Oh, yeah. 2.5 hour bus rides. Beautiful, beautiful country, beautiful bus ride. Super easy. It's a good spot. It's a tax haven. It's like Monaco. So it's blowing up, man. It's crazy. Like I went probably first time 10 years ago and now it's like just brand new buildings everywhere. But it's an extremely boring place after like 2 days. I don't know how people... It's like one of those places, like, really? Like, you're going to move there to dodge taxes and just be fucking so bored?
Yeah, I can see that.
Anyways, to each their own, right? But I'm assuming you're still in Kiev because when you picked up on video, which you turned off, you were sitting in the dark, what looked like a candlelight.
Yeah, basically.
Oh, man, Johnny.
So, I mean, the good news is I bought these new, like... warm light battery operated candles or lights that actually like, you know, have a nice, you know, orange glow to it. Cause my other ones are these rechargeable LED lights that are so brightly white that they just hurt your eyes. So it's either I'm in candlelight, which is often, you know, not enough, or I have these like bright daylights. So now I have this and it's kind of cozy. I like it.
Got to be rough some days. I'll tell you, cause even in Barcelona now, what I noticed is my apartment in the summer, it's like perfect because it doesn't get so much light that you like roast all day or need to run the AC all day. But in the winter, you don't get enough light because the sun, you know, is lower on the horizon and it's blocked by the buildings. And man, like in the winter, it's just gray and dark in my apartment all day. I'm like, oh, sucks. I would, if I did it all over again, I would have to get a place that faced the sun in the winter or had like rooftop access.
Yeah.
When I saw you there, I'm like, man, Kiev, a lot of gray days, winter, cold, without electricity. You got to be like in a dark area a lot of the time.
Yeah, yeah. Like it's depressing sometimes. Yeah. But luckily, my apartment itself actually gets a lot of natural light. Mm-hmm. And it was sunny today, just like surprisingly. So yeah, it was actually a nice little time. And last week, I was in Kharkiv, which has no people, but it has 24-hour electricity.
All right, dude, just pause right there because I have so many questions about that trip, but maybe we should save it for another episode.
Yeah, I think so. let's do that. So the reason why I know you were Andorra is I listened to the first few minutes of you catching up with the previous guest, Michael Foster. What sparked your idea to get him back on the show?
Well, actually, Michael and I were just catching up randomly and just talking about CEFs. And I'm like, I remember how much I was enjoying learning and also investing in CEFs. And in fact, I took out a sizable position in CEFs that specifically dealt with or had municipal bonds under management. But I haven't done anything. Like, I haven't touched those positions in 6 years. And that's kind of what I wanted to do with them. I just wanted to generate, my goal was to get enough income to be able to live off of that was tax-free, which municipal bonds is the way to do it, or unless you want to get real creative. But actually, that's not the way that he recommends to invest in municipal bonds, or sorry, in CEFs. He likes to kind of swing trade them a little bit, not like active trading like every single day, but get in and out of the positions every maybe half a year or so. And that's exactly what I was not doing. And I was also very interested in his newsletter business and why he, you know, why he does that and what the upside is potentially and some of the other comparables in the space. And it kind of related a little bit to having a podcast. And it was funny, some of the questions I asked him, what were some of the questions that he got from his audience? Because, you know, he's a very successful investor. So why is he taking so much time to write the newsletter? And it was just interesting conversation. So I said, let's bring it on the podcast. Lo and behold, I think it was a great interview. And man, I realized how much I'd like forgotten about what CEFs are and how to invest in them.
You know what? I actually have completely forgotten what CEFs were, and I had to Google it again. Or I guess you guys can listen to the previous episode. That was a while back. But CEF is a closed-end fund. It's kind of like an index fund, but instead of being passively managed through like an algorithm, it's managed by a person. So it has higher fees, but could potentially have higher payouts. What has been your experience with your CEFs that you bought?
Well, I think also the one main thing to add on to what you just said, which was accurate, Johnny, is that the closed-end fund means that it's got a capped amount that is under management.
Yeah.
So it could be, say, 200 million, where an index fund like the S&P 500 has no cap. Unlimited amount of money could go into the S&P 500, and all that money would just end up buying all those stocks, and the prices of those individual stocks would go up, and so would the price of the shares of the index. Where a closed-end fund is capped, which leaves a bit of opportunity to buy effectively the assets above or at a premium to the net asset value or at a discount. And that's where Michael Foster will tell us that they do analysis on these and get an edge, where basically they try to buy these funds at a discount. And to answer your question, Johnny, my strategy was basically to do that, to go in and buy municipal bond funds at a discount. So I knew I was getting a good price on them, or a price below, say, the actual asset value, and to hold them. But I'm happy with what I've been doing. I didn't even think to change my strategy, but I think I could have done or performed a much, much better if I was a little bit more active with them.
Can I ask you what percentage you've earned per year?
So what percentage I invested, or what percentage, what am I making a year?
Yeah, how much are you making a year from it?
I think I'm generating somewhere around like 40 to 50,000 US in dividends from the municipal bond funds, and all that's tax-free, which is what I wanted to do.
No, that's amazing. But like what percentage kind of earning would that be? Like, is that like a 7% earning per year, or higher or lower?
Oh, I think they're probably around 5.5% right now.
Okay.
So they're leveraged. So you get a bit of, like, if a typical municipal bonds, if you own the actual paper, it might pay out 2.5-3%, maybe a little bit more now. But these CEFs, they use leverage. So you'll get, you know, you tend to get you definitely get a higher dividend, but also that leverage increases the volatility of the fund a little bit. So these funds swing quite considerably. It's been kind of interesting to watch them, because when I got into the positions, they almost immediately went up 20%. So what I invested had a paper gain of 20% on the fund themselves. Then as interest rates started going up, now they've gone down 20%. So I'm probably on paper of a loss of 20% on average. But I guess the assumption is that as interest rates probably are at the top now, and if they start going down again, then these CEF funds will get more valuable. So we probably just covered the entire outro in the intro. So we won't much, but stay tuned. No.
I have a lot more to think about this, but let's take a listen to the interview with Michael Foster, and stay tuned to hear my thoughts, because as you guys know, I'm traditionally more of a index fund kind of passive investor, but this is interesting. So let's find a little bit more about CEFs and also the newsletter business, and let's hop back in.
This week's sponsor of Invest Like a Boss is Nom Nom. They deliver fresh dog food with every portion personalized to your dog's specific needs, so you can bring out their best. What you feed your dog is just as important as what you put into your own body. It's time for real good food backed by science. Nom Nom features pup-pleasing favorites like chicken cuisine and beef mash, and every Nom Nom meal features high-quality proteins and vegetables mixed with targeted vitamins and minerals to provide the essential nutrition dogs need at every life stage. In fact, Nom Nom's ingredients are cooked individually and then mixed. They're not just thrown into some huge pot and all stirred together. You can see each individual ingredient in every portion of Nom Nom dog food. This gives your dog efficient energy and packs in the vitamins and minerals they need to get the most out of every single bite. Plus, Nom Nom comes with a money-back guarantee. If your dog's tail isn't wagging within 30 days, Nom Nom will refund your first order. And I'm also going to give you half off your first order. You'll get a no-risk two-week trial at trynom.com/ilab. That's 50% off your first two-week trial at trynom.com/ilab. One more time, trynom.com/ilab.
All right, we're back on Invest Like a Boss. Great to have on Michael Foster, who's been twice previously on it here at Invest Like a Boss. Michael, how you been?
I'm good. I'm very good. How have you been, Sam?
I have been pretty good. Yeah, I've been all right.
Okay. That's always very believable.
It's always a bit shaky to start the year, you know, get the cobwebs out, get all the paperwork resettled, clean up the computer files, look at some old memories, and then you're off.
I would usually agree with you, but 2022 was such a horrible year for me that, New Year's Day, I wasn't hungover New Year's Day this year for the first time in maybe 20 years because I was so excited about the new year. I didn't drink. I'm like, first day, I'm gonna start working. I'm going to start planning for the new year. I was so excited because last year was trash, absolute total trash, and I expect this year to be great. And well, so far I've been right. So, you know, one down, 11 more to go.
I was halfway smiling as you were talking about your experience in 2022 because misery loves company. It was a rough one for a lot of people, especially speaking mostly of Derek, Johnny, and I. We often gripe about the woes of 2022. But hey, onto the new one. I was just reflecting on when you and I met originally, but also just having you on Invest Like a Boss back in the day. I was looking at episode 63 and episode 68.
Long time ago.
Yeah, it's been you've been a long time friend of the show, a long time friend of me. So it's great to have you back on. And we kind of touched base. Yeah, man. We touched base, I guess, a few weeks ago, just on various topics and talked about a new episode on the podcast. And I've always been quite intrigued with your newsletter, CEF Insider. So I wanted to catch up on that. And then you also had some insights that you thought would be worth sharing. So for the listeners, we never really got back in the previous episodes to when you started CEF Insider and kind of the intention behind that or the intention building up to that. So maybe you could take us back there as a way to kind of introduce that to the audience.
All right. Okay. Let me do my villain origin story and I'll try to make it as fast as possible, which is hard for me because I've been known to blabber. All right. So I was not originally in the financial world or trained in finance. My background is in historical linguistics. And whenever I tell anyone that, they ask, how the hell did you end up in finance? And the trajectory actually kind of makes sense. I mean, it really started in the great financial crisis when, you know, that crisis just killed all the jobs. It was very hard to get a professorship. And I ended up taking a position in a university and a country that I hated. And, you know, as I was beginning my academic career and talking to mentors, I realized I hate this and I want to get out. And not just that, but I felt trapped because when you have such a bizarre, obscure field like I did, you don't have 100 universities around the world to choose from. And at the same time, the jobs were disappearing because all the universities, they were running out of money. They were doing hiring freezes. So I applied to like 25 jobs and half of the universities wrote back to everyone who applied and said, we're having a hiring freeze. We aren't hiring anyone. So I was like, it's hard enough to get a job in this industry. And when you add that on top, I realized I am not free. I do not have freedom. And I am a victim of the economy. I'm always going to be, under the thumb of whatever's happening on a sort of macro level due to things I cannot control. That was a terrible feeling. And I think nowadays, I don't want to sound like an old man, but I will anyway. Nowadays, a lot of young people go on the internet and just complain about it. Yeah, man, they'll start moderating the anti-work subreddit. I never had that attitude. I've always been very pragmatic. So I'm like, okay, well, if Goldman Sachs just destroyed the world economy and those bankers got multi-million bonuses doing so, how do I do that? How do I get those bonuses without, whether I destroy the economy or not? And, at the same time, realizing just how little power I had over my life and how important for me, economics was, I started to read about it intensely. I realized this was a very important topic. I learned more and more. And so I started writing about it and I started getting paid to write about it. That turned into financial journalism. And at the same time, I was doing my own personal investing, largely in CEFs, but not entirely. And very quickly, I was, not to brag, but I was doing very, very well to the point where, I had enough money saved that it would cover my very, very frugal expenses. And that's when I quit my professorship. I continued as a financial journalist because I found it fun. I was kind of discovered by an investment bank on Wall Street. I started working as a sell-side analyst for a group of hedge funds, doing very, very detailed technical research on stocks. I still do that kind of part-time. I guess you can call me a hedge fund consultant in my free time. And on top of that, of course, I write the CEF Insider newsletter. The newsletter and my research is actually providing a valuable service. I get letters from readers who are saying, thank you. I thought I wouldn't be able to retire for another 30 years. And I just retired last year. That's a great feeling. And that's one of the things that keeps me going on. Well, that and the money, of course.
That's great. That's a great intro. So how long now have you been writing? Like, this whole story kind of came to a climax in terms of you leaving the professorship and then starting to write financial journalism. How long ago was that?
It was a little over a decade ago. And then I started CEF Insider it was 6 years ago. My hedge fund research work, I started pretty shortly after becoming a journalist. It was 11 years ago. So that's, I've been in this now longer than I was ever in academia.
So this brings back some memories. You mentioned the sell side analyst for hedge funds. What's that specifically helping them make decisions on when to sell or get out of positions?
Well, essentially, yes. The way that the hedge funds work, if you're familiar with the mosaic theory of investing, the idea is that, think about the parable of the blind men and the elephant. They're all touching different parts of the element of the elephant. So they describe different things, a wall, a tree, so on and so forth. The mosaic theory is basically you get a bunch of research from different people with different special skills, to quote Liam Neeson, you put it all together and then you can discover the elephant.
Yeah, this is funny because when we were recording episode 63 and we were all riding around in a limousine, and I remember you're like,
I remember that.
We got to pull over somewhere so I can take a call for my, and you start telling us about how you're a consultant for hedge funds. And like, well, you can just do it in the limo. And you're like, nah, I don't think so. Like, let's pull over and I'll go stand on the side of a building, someplace quiet. But we had the same thing where we were,
what was going on in that
yeah. We were trying to record this episode in the limo and keep everyone quiet at the same time. It wasn't entirely possible, but it was fun. But this brings me back, before we get more into the newsletter, this is actually really funny because a long time ago I took a position in this REIT called Senior Housing Properties. It was paying like a 14% dividend. And I was talking about it and I mentioned it to you maybe like a year after being in that position. I distinctly remember I was in my bathroom and I get a message from Michael saying, hey man, I know you're in this REIT, Senior Housing Trust. I have to say, I'm really concerned about it. I did some analysis on it and like, there's just no way that they're going to be able to pay their dividend, which means they're going to have to cut their dividend. When they cut their dividend, price is going to get whacked. And I was like, I was just kind of like, how bad could it really be? Like never having been through this before. And I'm thinking naively, I'm like, well, they're paying a 13% dividend. What if they cut it to like 11%? No big deal.
Yeah,
and I think maybe the REIT was already down like 10%. I'm like, well, I'm not going to take a loss now, Lo and behold, that thing is now down like 96% or something. I think I've got a paper loss of, it's definitely six digit loss. Like I put in maybe 150 on it. I think the mm-hmm. value of it now is worth like 10, and I still don't know what to do with it. I'm like, is this thing just going to go totally bust and I just take a full write off? So I should have listened, you know?
Well, you know, I have to admit, well, firstly, I don't remember that. I believe it, but I hate to say this, but people say things like that to me a lot. And I remember when I first got into this, I used to get really frustrated. And I think it was really crypto that made me stop being frustrated with this, because especially last year, but also in 2018, you know, I got a lot of response from readers and well, people I know and friends and investors, you know, who had lost a shitload of money on crypto and were very, very upset about it. And, you know, you can only say, well, I told you so many times. Mm-hmm. And now the attitude that I have more is, I guess, kind of cutthroat, where it's like, well, this is an open market of people with freedom to make their own choices. And if you make bad choices in the market, that's an opportunity for smarter people such as myself to come in and make money off of you. And, you know, that's what markets are. And, you know, understanding how to do the research to find those kinds of mistakes and errors that can happen at many levels within the market. It can either be the fundamental analysis or the expectation that, you know, the greater fool is always going to be there, but you're actually too late to the party and you don't know it. These are all kinds of research that you can do. And if you're good at it, and if you know how to write and articulate yourself, you can package it into something that not only has economic value, but can also, you know, help you build something that really helps a lot of people out there. And, you know, I really love helping people make money. I think it's great. You know, when my readers are making a ton of money, energy is another big one. I've warned investors in a lot of bad energy funds, and, you know, getting emails saying, thank you, I didn't lose 90%. And I have friends who are down. I have a friend who, you know, is a big peak oil guy. He lost about 80% of his net worth a few years ago. It was back in 2014, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, these are opportunities. If you really understand markets, the newsletter becomes like a centerpiece for a community, and we all get together and we can talk about where we think markets are going, why, and then make money off it. And that's great. You know, it's a really nice little industry that I found myself in.
Could you be as effective in your own investments if you didn't have the newsletter? Or another way to put it is, like, does by doing the newsletter force you to learn kind of this alpha of information that you wouldn't have if you were just investing your personal finances into? Yeah,
that's a really good question. I think that kind of dovetails with the one question I get from people about newsletters the most is, well, you know, if you're so good, why don't you just invest your own money and not bother with the newsletter? Well, number one, I do invest my own money, and I do very well. And I have my own private spreadsheet where I calculate, you know, how much money I earn from my businesses, and how much I would need in, you know, assets under management or my own personal assets for the alpha that I could get not investing in the newsletter, because that frees you up with a lot of regulatory red tape. Like, there are certain times when I cannot buy certain funds. Without that, in theory, I could invest more efficiently, make more money more quickly. And so I constantly calculate, well, is that number greater than the revenue I get from the newsletter? And it's not. And at the point when it is, maybe I'll quit. I don't know. I do really enjoy doing it. But until then, I don't have an economic incentive to stop writing the newsletter. And I think that's true for a lot of newsletter writers. You know, it's not just me. There are a lot of guys who are really, really good at, you know, their specific thing. And they could make a lot of extra money trading on their stuff that they can't legally do writing a newsletter. But the delta between that and, you know, how much they're making with the newsletter is a constant question that you have to keep in mind as a newsletter writer.
So when people ask you that, actually, I want to go back to that question, because I've had this question as well, but I feel like what you're writing about is a little bit more conservative, where I would, if someone's writing about index funds, that's a little bit more palatable for our audience. Someone's writing about index funds and they're really good at analyzing index funds. I don't think the question in my mind would pop up like, why is this really successful person writing about index funds? Except that it's a time commitment, I guess. But if someone's writing about crypto and they're saying that they've made, you know, something that's very speculative, but also the potential to make 100x returns are there, and they're claiming that they've made so much money, then it's like, okay, why are you writing a crypto trading publication talking about how much money you made when, you know, writing this publication, there's no way that you could make the type of money that you're said that you're claiming to make on this trading. But like, how would you answer that if someone says that to you? You said that's a common question, right?
Yeah. No, that's something worth considering, because, you know, you have to take the claims of any newsletter writer with a grain of salt, and you have to be very, very skeptical. One of the things we do is we offer, I'm not a part of the monetization or the marketing side, because I find that stuff really boring. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember if we do a 30-day money back guarantee or something like that, or you get the first month or something like that. But anyway, you know, we have a sort of try before you buy model. Mm-hmm. In my hedge fund work, we do that sometimes with the hedge funds too. You know, I think that just analyzing the work, you know, read a couple of issues of the newsletter, and you should have the knowledge to be able to judge for yourself. Well, is this good enough, or is this person a charlatan? And there are a lot of charlatans in the newsletter business. I won't deny that at all. I won't name names, although I have names. I mean, and some of these people absolutely just do not believe in what they're writing and will freely tell you so over a beer. It's really annoying being grouped into an industry with those kinds of people. So I think the way to think about newsletters, right, is that, you know, there's kind of a sliding scale of risk, right? There is the most ridiculously risky thing, like Bored Ape NFTs or derivatives on Bored Ape NFTs as briefly existed. And then on the other side, yeah, you've got like an index fund of U.S. treasuries. So like CEF Insider is definitely on the more conservative side of that. The reason I don't actually think it's very conservative is I do think there's a cutoff point where there are certain things that just, it isn't that it's riskier, it's bullshit, it's a scam, it's you know, and I don't want to kick crypto while it's down, but that's a pretty good example, you know, Beanie Babies and other kinds of Ponzi schemes and SBF and so on and so forth. History is littered with these kinds of things. But I do think most newsletters that focus on stocks, bonds, real estate, you know, they're going to be driven by either a perspective on fundamental investing or macroeconomic investing that is going to make people money over the long term.
And so with CEF Insider, what's kind of the value proposition of people that are reading that? Are they people that are looking to try to edge out the market conservatively? Are they people that are trying to just diversify across new assets? Someone that's reading your publications, not trying to 3x their money in 12 months, I guess is kind of what I'm trying to understand.
Yeah. I think that my readers have different goals as I've, you know, interacted with them over the years. I do think our readers skew probably a bit older than your audience probably does. But because of that, you know, they are definitely looking for income. And the main idea with them, you know, if you're in your 50s or 60s, the idea is that I'm tired. I don't want to work anymore. Now, what can I possibly do to ensure that I'm going to have enough money and I won't be on the streets? You know, on a very basic level, that's kind of what they're looking for. And what I'm looking for, I think, is a bit more abstract, where the newsletter introduces readers to a lot of tools that can provide you financial freedom faster than you think you can get it. You know, when I was younger, I just assumed you spend 50 years in a career and then you retire and then you die. I didn't realize, like, you don't have to be an entrepreneur. There are tools in the market that, you know, you can retire on far less than $1 million if you have a very frugal lifestyle. Like, that's an option out there. And, you know, when I realized that in my late 20s or early 30s, I started working towards that. And I got that in within a few years. And I you know, I didn't just use it to play video games for the rest of my life. I then embarked on another career where I could choose jobs based upon what I wanted to do instead of what I had to do, which is why, you know, I initially was a freelance journalist, and that was a perfect fit for, you know, having enough money in the bank that, you know, I could pay the rent, I could eat, so on and so forth.
How would you measure, I guess, not the success outright of the newsletter, but the success of the content that you're publishing? Like, do you mm-hmm. track the stocks that actually, to be honest, I think I read a CEF Insider going back when you first came on the podcast, but I haven't read one since. Are you actually making mm-hmm. picks? Are you selecting CEFs that you think are good buys?
Oh, yes.
And then suggesting
Absolutely.
Them, and then you track, do you have any type of like tracking on that internally or publicly yes. that shows, hey, these were good mm-hmm. picks, or this one was dog shit?
Yes. So all of our open positions and closed positions are published on the website. So you can see our track record. You can see how well we've done. My publisher is a little skittish about publishing these numbers because theoretically, you know, you can get fined by the FTC. You know, if you write 8.1%, but it was really just 8%, you can get mm-hmm. fined. They're very, very nervous about that. But I personally track it, despite the fact that the CEF Insider portfolio is diversified into lower performing assets like muni bonds. Before 2022, the CEF Insider was outperforming the S&P 500 by a pretty significant margin, while also having an average yield of around 8.5% at the time. The yield's much higher now, obviously. I believe it's 9.1% at the moment.
It's crazy yield.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's a crazy yield on, you know, the portfolio is a mix of funds that hold Apple, Microsoft, Amazon. There's some real estate funds. There's muni bond funds. There's some corporate bond funds. None of this is, you know, buying JPEGs on the internet. This is all, you know, pretty reasonable stuff. And, you know, if you're getting a 10% yield, if you have $500,000 in the bank, that's 50 grand a year. You know, 500 grand isn't that much money for savings, but 50 grand a year is a middle class income. And it's pretty incredible that it doesn't really take that much to be middle class if you know about CEFs and you use them, which is how I use them. And also, you don't have to sacrifice returns, because I haven't tracked how many of our funds outperform their indexes, but historically it has been almost all of them. Part of the reason for that, and part of the reason why now the yield is so great, is because, you know, CEFs can trade at a discount or a premium, and that's really their magic. You buy a CEF at a discount, so you can get like Apple stock for 20% less than what you would buy just buying a straight Apple stock from your broker. And then when the CEF goes to a premium, you sell it, you're getting, you know, an 8-9% income stream the entire time, and then you're selling for a profit. This was what I was doing, you know, shortly after the great financial crisis, when I was desperately trying to get out of academia. And my God, did it work. It worked ridiculously well, to the point where, you know, you can make 50-60% returns within a year without dealing with, you know, the Sam Bankman-Frieds of the world. That's amazing. That Wow. motivates me. Yeah, that motivates me not just to keep writing the newsletter, you know, for my own personal interest, so that I know these funds in and out and can buy them at the best possible time. But also, you know, it results in a product that has real economic value. If you're 35, you hate your life, you hate your job, you've got 400 grand in the bank, your financial advisor is telling you, you got to wait till you've got 2 mil minimum. I can tell you that's not true. It's total bullshit. You know, your financial advisor is probably telling you that because he wants you to keep paying, you know, the 1% management fee per year. You know, chuck me $400 a year. I will show you these funds, following them, you know, invest in them when you're supposed to, get out of them when you're supposed to, and you can make huge returns and have a solid passive income stream. And, you know, when I started writing about this stuff, you know, I only started writing about this years after I'd already been doing it. And when I initially started writing about closed-end funds, the feedback I constantly got from readers was, this isn't going to work. You're wrong. There's something wrong about this. I remember when I was a financial journalist, there was one website in particular, not a good website, but I was kind of writing for everyone at the time. And so I pitched this story about closed-end funds and investing, you know, in high-yield investments to retire early. Number one, the editor shot it down, saying, you can't retire and withdraw more than 4% a year. It never, ever works. The financial advisor who originally created that rule has since denounced it, which we could talk about later. And secondly, you know, I'd been doing it for years. And the only reason I was writing for this website was because I had the financial freedom to leave my professorship and pursue this, you know, hobby as a career kind of thing. And yeah, she hated it so much that, you know, my editor not only rejected that, but fired me from the website. I mean, I was a freelancer, but basically said, yeah, we don't want you to write for us anymore. A few years later, I'm writing CEF Insider, and I think we might be making more revenue than that website is now.
And you just got me excited about CEFs again. Back up to the strategy, because I was a little bit blurry on who's buying CEFs. The way that, that you're doing it is much more, or recommended to do, is much more systematic with like buying and selling. It's not necessarily holding these CEFs for 5-10 years, right?
There are some CEFs that are long-term holds. There are a couple of CEFs that I have recommended for pretty much the entirety of the publication. Mm-hmm. And I do mention times when they are better buys and times when they're not so great buys. So you can kind of trade around core positions if you want to. Mm-hmm. But no, absolutely. CEFs can offer you long-term positions. I mean, I would say at CEF Insider, I don't try to target a holding period. I know that a lot of publications do. My attitude is no one can really do that because we are all victims to the market. If you don't believe me, just think back to last year. I think after 2022, everyone believes that. Sometimes, you know, a CEF is going to be good for 3 months. Sometimes that same fund will be good for 5 years. I can think of a good example is PHK. PHK was a long-term hold for years and years and years until it became a sudden sell. Then it became an obvious, you know, 3 to 6 month swing trader. Mm-hmm. Now it's still kind of that, but also kind of dead. Number one, these things change because of the market. Number two, these things change because of the changes in the funds themselves. Yeah. So I really try to target just holding when it's best, but that means that the portfolio has some things you hold for a couple months, some things you hold for several years.
Got it. And just to be clear, like the reason that CEFs can produce such high yield, I think you just said right now the average is 9.1%, which for your typical investor like myself, that's largely in index funds, you're thinking, no way. Like how could you produce 9.1% when my high yield dividend fund in Vanguard is paying like 2.8%. It is right. Because the CEFs use leverage. Is that correct?
That is a small part of it, but not the most important part. A lot of CEFs do not employ leverage. The majority do, but there are a lot that do not. I think the best way to understand this, I'll try not to be too technical, but think about the S&P 500, right? The long-term average annual return for the S&P 500 is about 8% a year. Mm-hmm. Now, if you have a CEF that completely replicates the S&P 500's return and returns all of those profits in income, it's an 8% yielding fund and its dividend will never be cut. So really what CEFs are designed to do and what the best ones do is translate illiquid returns into liquid returns. And really all that means is that it helps you translate your profits into income without you having to buy and sell. Why won't you just buy and sell yourself? Well, anyone who has tried to buy and sell themselves knows why you don't want to do that. You know, it is not only extremely labor intensive, it is very risky. And you know, if anyone listening thinks that they can beat the market, all I would ask them to do is Google the efficient frontier. Read, firstly, the Wikipedia article on it, then read a couple of the academic articles on the topic. Just choose anyone that you'll find on Google Scholar, and then tell me you can beat the market. You know, a lot of people criticize hedge funds. You see this on Wall Street Bets, most obviously. There is a lot of criticism about, you know, professional institutional investors. They're crooks, they're criminals, you know, they're evil, what have you. The reality is they're nerds. They're doing very, very complicated math. It is as complicated as, you know, astrophysics. It's pretty much the same math in many cases. You know, it's very, very complex theoretical statistics. So no individual person no one, you know, not Warren Buffett can replicate that. Even Warren Buffett has a massive team of people to do this. CEFs provide this within an easy to trade wrapper. You know, they use all of that acumen, and the goal is, okay, you know, if it's a equity fund, we're going to try to get 8-9% returns per year, and we're going to try to translate that into 8-9% income, but we're going to do it in a way that we aren't buying low or buying high and selling low, which a lot of people end up doing when they try to translate their, you know, long-term gains in capital markets into income.
Got it. So you can make that yield, and then you can also make a gain on the buy and sell price, because the trick is you're trying to buy these funds when they're selling at historic gold discounts to their NAV, and then you sell them mm-hmm. when you're high. And what's your typical hold period for a CEF? I'm sure it ranges a lot, but is there kind of like an average of how long you'd be in these CEF positions?
The average has definitely changed, but I think now it's probably about a year and a half to 2 years.
Okay. So it's not like you need to be in there every single day buying and selling.
No, but usually what happens is, tremendous opportunities show up. And also at the moment, we're now recommending over 20 funds, which means, you know, there's a lot of movement in there. You know, there's a lot of things swapping in and out all the time, even with a 1 to 2 year holding period.
So this is actually interesting, because I have a pretty sizable position in municipal bond CEFs, which I love, because I'm getting something around like 5% mm-hmm. Tax-free. And when I bought those, they were all at historical discounts. Mm-hmm. And then the price went way up. And I think like my average fund was up somewhere like 20%. And I was like, this is great. They're up 20%. And I'm making this great tax-free dividend. And then they all, mm-hmm. and as interest rates went up, all the prices went down. But I've always viewed them as long-term positions, so I'm not really sweating the volatility in the pricing. But I guess if I was subscribing to your newsletter, probably what the recommendation would have been is to sell them when the price went up so much, and then take new positions in something else. Does that sound pretty fair?
That's exactly the way it works. I assume those are the muni bond CEFs you asked me about many years ago.
Yeah, like 7 years ago.
I mean, a lot's changed in 7 years. Yeah, muni bond CEFs are interesting. And it's not just muni bond CEFs. Actually, a lot of the credit CEFs have this in common. Actually, a couple of years ago, all of the preferred stock CEFs were beating the preferred stock index since inception, which means that every single preferred stock CEF was outperforming the market. Most corporate bond CEFs outperform the market. I would say about, I haven't looked at this in a few months, but I seem to remember it was about 65 to 70% of real estate CEFs outperformed their index. There's a lot of outperformance out there. It's just a matter of finding it. And then, of course, you can compound that by, like you did, buying it at historical discounts and NAV. But the problem is you've got to also sell at the right time too. Sure. But it doesn't matter, because I'm actually pretty constructive about muni bonds at this moment, so you'll probably be fine. Although I must say I'm kind of bullish on everything right now, which I've been for about 6 months.
That's great. I want to get into that before we close up, but just a couple other quick questions on the newsletter front.
Yeah, sure.
So I've always wondered also, like, how much money can be made on some of these newsletters? Like I interviewed Mark Faber of the Gloom Boom, whatever. A while ago, and he's obviously probably got a fairly large publication, or at least probably previously did. In your network of people that I'm sure you know, other people that write successful publications, like, is there significant money to be made, or is it? I mean, I guess you can compare it to any other kind of form of media. Like, there's podcasts, maybe 1% are mm-hmm. quite successful, and 99%. Don't even break even. But what's your view into it?
Yeah, that's a good question, because there's a long tail on newsletters, and I don't really know what's going on there. I can tell you this. I do know that some newsletters are making 8 figures. And I'm not talking 10 million. I'm talking much more than that.
Wow.
I do know of one publishing company that specialized in just newsletters, and about 10 years ago, their revenue was about $70 million. They had several newsletters. I know this because they offered me a job that I turned down. The owner kind of felt like a psychopath to me. Mm-hmm. But so there's a lot of money to be made, you know, to kind of give you a peek behind the kimono. When we first started CEF Insider, I had a long chat with our publisher. And he asked me, like, you know, what do you want? What is your goal? And I told him, you know, I don't want to make a huge business where I'm, you know, going to be on CNBC as a talking head and constantly trying to turn it into a big enterprise. That was an option for us. You know, we had the resources to do that. But, you know, we kind of wanted to keep it small and manageable, you know, mm-hmm. customer service. The more people you have subscribing, the more customer service is a hassle. The more people you have subscribing, the more your recommendations move markets, and that hurts your total returns. So we kind of want to keep it, you know, there's a balance. It's like you don't want to make it so small that it's not making money, but you don't want it to be so massive that it's actually not providing alpha.
Yeah.
And if you're really, really, you know, scrupulous, you can make a lot. I mean, tens of millions of dollars is on the table.
Well, I just ran some quick numbers. It's like, all right, if you had 10,000 subscribers a month at $30 a month, which I don't know if that, does that seem reasonable in terms of the newsletter business monthly publication?
It's a bit low, actually.
Bit low. Okay. Well, if you had that 10,000 a month at $30 a month, that would be close, more or less 3 million, a little over 3 million. But that is hard to do. Just even knowing, comparing it to like podcasting, to get 10,000 people to listen to your podcast for free each month, mm-hmm. that puts you in the top 0.01% of podcasts globally.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and that's a free publication that's easy to digest. It's just delivered straight to your app. So I imagine breaking that in terms of getting people to pay you each month to read something has mm-hmm. to be a massive long tail to it.
Yeah, so there's you can kind of see the bits of that long tail on Seeking Alpha, which I have written for in the past. I still write for it every once in a while. There's something particularly important I want to get out there. You know, what you very clearly see from that is there are a lot of people launching a lot of services, many of which have a lot of overlap. And, you know, some have overlap with CEF Insider. I've seen a few of those newsletters over time. People I know or friends of friends who've given up because it wasn't making enough money. Some of those do make pretty good money, but I kind of feel bad for those guys because it is kind of a commoditized marketplace where they're struggling to compete, which kind of sucks because a lot of those guys are great. There are a couple of, you know, even my competitors, there are a couple of guys who write about CEFs on Seeking Alpha who are really, really good. Douglas Albo is a good example. He's publicly written attacking stuff that I've written about CES, but I still think that he's brilliant. He's very, very solid. He does great analysis. You know, it's kind of hard to discover him when you're on a platform like that. A lot of newsletter writers come out of the wealth management business, and I think it's something that they try to leverage. So they have connections of the people whose wealth they manage, and they try to use that to create a newsletter business. That was sort of the pre-internet model. And I think a lot of people are still trying to do that. But if you're not coming from wealth management like me, you know, I was coming from the, you know, asset management world, which is a sort of hedge fund world, breaking into this industry, you can't really do that. And so you have to have a sales channel that gets you to the right people. And also you have to have a very, very good product that not only makes people money, but keeps them reading. And there are a lot of skills involved in that, right? Like you have to be good at marketing. You have to make the right connections with the right people who are well-positioned that you can trust. You have to be good at financial analysis. You have to be at least a decent writer. There's a lot of stuff going on to make a newsletter work.
Yeah, it's got to be easy to digest, not too technical, probably a little bit of humor occasionally. Are you mm-hmm. writing all of your newsletters now, or do you have a team to help you?
No, I write everything myself. I've never employed a ghostwriter in my life. I have been a ghostwriter way back in my freelance journalism days, but no, I do it all myself.
Wow. Okay. So that's, so there's definitely some pretty significant work involved in that in terms of research and analysis, and then actually writing and publishing the letter.
I mean, I guess, you know, a lot of people ask me like, you know, what's your work day like and stuff like that. And it's so hard for me to answer that question. Cause like, number one, I would still be doing all of this research for myself. Mm-hmm. Number two, I like writing. You know, I went to school. Originally, I went to university studying English literature.
Sounds so boring.
Different strokes and all, but like I really wanted to be a writer when I was young. And I actually had a mentor at UCLA who was a multiple New York Times bestseller who encouraged me a lot. And, I absolutely loved writing, but I kind of fell out of love with novels and fiction. Mm-hmm. And when I stumbled into newsletters, I was like, oh my God, this is perfect. You know, it tickles the analytical part of my brain. Mm. It is capital markets are great because it's purely meritocratic. If you're wrong, you lose money. So you get rewarded if you're smart and good. I get to write. I get an audience who actually enjoys reading what I'm writing. Mm-hmm. I love what I'm doing. So you could say, it takes time, but it's time that I'd probably be spending drinking beer if I wasn't writing this. So it's probably better for me in the long term.
Can get in trouble. I'm about to have a huge gap in my workload starting next month, and I'm more nervous than I'm excited, simply because when you don't have enough things to keep you busy.
that's dangerous. Well, I'll send you a list of good craft Spanish beers. There are a few of them.
I knew you were going to do this to me.
No. I'll help your liver get a workout.
Send me a care package. Another question that popped up as you're talking about kind of mathematicians and all these really clever people that are working for hedge funds. Have you ever heard of a company called Renaissance Technology?
Yes. I can neither confirm nor deny if they have been one of my clients.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. I know RenTech very well. Let me just state for the record, I cannot mention who any of my clients are. And I know that sounds like a really like cheeky, asshole-ish thing to say. It's just a regulatory thing. But I can say, I did this calculation a while ago and it's changed now, but the average AUM of our clients was about 20 billion. I'm not sure where it's at now, but basically it's the largest hedge funds because the price point we have for our research, it's usually not economical for the smaller hedge funds. So yeah, I kind of know all the big ones.
Jeez, Renaissance Technology came up on this recent episode that we just published on ChatGPT. And we were asking could AI create an edge in trading? And the guest, Tom, was like, well, they already have. It already has.
They've been doing it. Yeah.
And I'm like, why haven't I heard of them? And can I get invested in them and all this? And it's like, wow, I did some research on them. I was just blown away. But
you got to read Flash Boys. It's Michael Lewis's worst book. And I disagree with Michael Lewis entirely in that book specifically. That's all about HFT and dark pools for hedge fund trading and all that stuff. And, it's really crazy the extents to which these companies go to eke out a fraction of a penny per trade. But, when you scale that up, you're suddenly making essentially free money.
So badass, I have to say. I'm super intrigued by this. I got to figure a route into it.
Let me just say for the record, I would never in my life trade what I'm doing for what anyone in RenTech is doing, despite the amount of money they make. Let me just say that.
That's good. So it's a passion that you have.
And I'm sure they'd agree with me. Okay. Well, no, it's not so much that. It's that working on the buy side in a hedge fund is hell. It is absolute total hell.
It's like just endless work, or what's the stress in it?
Well, you really have no job security and you can make an awful lot of money for sure. But there is tremendous stress and pressure. It is a very, very demanding job where getting even the slightest thing wrong can result in people losing millions and millions of dollars. Do we have time? Do we have time for me to just tell a very quick anecdote on this topic?
Of course.
Okay. So I can tell this because I'm not working for the company anymore. And this is so long ago, it doesn't matter. But way back in 2013, I wrote a report on Pandora. And while we can't explicitly say this, basically the headline was, you'd be an idiot if you didn't buy calls on Pandora right now and hold into earnings, which one of our clients did and made about $75 million in a day. That's the kind of, synergies between different people contributing different bits of specialty knowledge can result in massive, massive outperformance. But the downside of that is throughout that process, if one person gets one thing wrong, then you can lose that much money in a second. And I have seen that also happen in hedge funds as well. And it's an emotional roller coaster. It's the same reason why I gave up trading options. It's too stressful. I just don't want that in my life.
I was just going to say, it's too much excitement for me. I just want to wake up with no stress, no emotions about trading. I mean, it is fun to pick stocks occasionally, you know, if you can stomach the loss, but option trading or something that's that involved on a regular basis, not for me, definitely not anymore anyways.
Yeah. I mean, it's ultimately the question is, what's the point of money? What do you want the money for? I remember a few years ago, I read a tweet by Cliff Asness, who's the head of AQR, multi-billionaire hedge fund guy. And he tweeted about, he had a, I think it was a can of like canned sausages. And he opened it up and they were spoiled. And so he tweeted about, yeah, this fucking can of sausages has gone bad. I just opened it. And I just picture this multi-billionaire, you know, in his parlor opening up this can of sausages. And it's like, yeah, you know, so many of these people are in this industry trying to make more and more and more money. And they're not happy people. They're just not.
Just wrapping up the episode, Michael, before we break, I'm just interested in kind of the state of markets in your view. You had mentioned that you're recommending a lot of funds right now. I'm guessing you see this as a buying opportunity, at least in the niche of CEFs.
I mean, I think because CEFs are tightly correlated to other assets, I think it's kind of a buying opportunity for kind of everything. So what happened in 2022, obviously, is that the market was scared of two things, the Fed and inflation. The Fed interest rate hikes were very predictable. And, you know, as a result, 2022 produced a tremendous amount of buying opportunities as the market overreacted and anticipated the, you know, rate hikes to possibly go on for much longer. That's over. Fed is most likely going to raise hike rates again in March. And then crucially, the FOMC does not meet in April, which kind of gives a break in the cadence of FOMC releases so that when they come back in May, they can come in and say, we're not going to raise rates anymore. Going to keep them where we are. That's what the market's pricing in. So there is a risk if that doesn't happen of a kind of sell in May and go away situation. Mm-hmm. But if it does not happen, you know, the near 20% gain that we've seen so far in 2022 is just going to continue. That's my base view. The inflation issue, I will admit, I did expect inflation to be a problem after the pandemic due to supply side constraints. I do still think that it was demand pull inflation, not cost push inflation, meaning it's a good kind of inflation and it's not going to last long. And it's actually a sign of a fundamentally strong economy. I think 4Q GDP numbers have borne that out. The market has begun to realize that. So that's why the market soared in January. I think that momentum is most likely to continue. We're going to have corrections, of course. We can't end the year up 100%. But, you know, could we end up 30% like we did in 2013? I think it's pretty possible. More probable is we end the year up, you know, 20-25% for the S&P 500. That's what I'm targeting.
And how about any CEFs that look particularly good right now that you're able to share?
Yeah, I think the tech CEFs in particular are quite good. A lot of them are still heavily discounted. So AIO, BST, BSTZ, and there's another one whose ticker I'm forgetting. Off the top of my head, there are a few of them out there. They're all ETG, ETY are pretty heavily discounted and interesting. Mm-hmm. I'm particularly bullish on corporate bonds, actually. And I kind of feel like there are a lot of corporate bond CEFs that are still discounted like 15%. Mm-hmm. The thing about a corporate bond now is that there are a lot of investment grade corporate bonds yielding like 6-7%. Right. And these are 10-year bonds. So you can lock in 10-year pretty much risk-free 6-7% yield. And then you get a CEF where that's holding a lot of those at a discount. You're looking at a very, very sustainable income stream and a ton of total returns over the long term.
I got to reevaluate a lot of things that I'm doing after this on some of my strategies, but it's been super informative. We need to get you back on the show more often, and you and I need to go grab beers definitely more often.
Hit me up next time you're in Thailand.
Yeah, hopefully soon, man. Real quick before we break, just a quick shout out to your newsletter, CF Insider? Where can people find more information or maybe even trial it if they're interested?
Oh, that's a good question. You can go to contrarianoutlook.com and look for CEF Insider. There's another website. I think cefinsider.com still works. You can see I really, really care about making money with this newsletter, how prepared I am in marketing it. Yes, that works. cefinsider.com.
All right, Michael, it's been great having you on the show.
Likewise.
Hopefully catch up soon in person.
Sam, I feel like I'm even more confused now about what a CEF is than before this interview.
I actually thought you were going to say, I thought you were going to get on this outro and say, this sounds perfect for me. Like, why aren't we doing this instead of our completely passive index fund investing? Because it feels like it's all the benefits of sort of like investing in Vanguard CEFs, Vanguard index funds, but with a bit of an edge that I think can be capitalized on.
You know, it's funny. We've been talking every week on this podcast for 7 years now, and I feel like you don't know my strategy at all.
Just get as much money into Vanguard as possible and call it a day.
Yeah. I don't want an edge. I don't want somebody touching the money. I don't want someone trading it and you know, potentially having high fees on there. I just want to let it kind of like set it and forget it. And I definitely don't want, you know, someone triggering a sale every 6 months, because I don't know what the tax implications of that would be. But yeah, I would much rather just put my money into, you know, whatever basket of funds and just let it sit there, you know, managed by an algorithm that doesn't buy or sell for, you know, 6 years, 10 years, you know, 20 years, rather than put it into a CEF fund that has higher fees. And, you know, potentially, yeah, maybe you can make more money, but also it's more risky. Whenever something's leveraged, it's always riskier.
Yeah, it's a good point. And one thing I've appreciated after doing this podcast with you for 7 years is you are much more disciplined than I. And I strive to be disciplined in investing, but I always end up just getting into new things when I get excited. So, for instance, PPR Note, they have like a 12% fund that they just released. And I'm like, gotta do it. And immediately on signing the papers, I'm like, why did I do that? It's like one more investment, one more K-1, a tax inefficient investment. You know, I'm going to get taxed at like 35% on that. I'm like, why am I doing that? My whole goal is just to consolidate and to simplify everything going forward. And still, like, these things come out, these opportunities come out, and I like pounce on them. I did check, Johnny, with Michael after the episode on the tax. He said it's 80%. Of the dividends from CEF funds, and this is just an average across CEF funds, is qualified dividends, which means it would be taxed, I guess, at the 15% to 20%. So they do seem very tax efficient.
Okay. Well, at least there's that. But I don't know. It's definitely not for me, Sam. But have you invested more? Are you going to invest more?
Well, I was actually thinking, like, as I was interviewing Michael, I was like, why don't Johnny and I just do this, like, why isn't this our little thing? You know, we could be making much more cash in a tax efficient way. And we probably, it suits our type of investing style. Cause you know, we go in and we make maybe trade it like every 3 months or 6 months, but it's not like we need to go in there every week and touch it. And I thought, because you were investing in municipal bonds, not municipal bond funds, what were they? MLPs. And you did well with the MLPs. You seem to like it. They tax efficient, generated good dividend. You got some capital appreciation on it. Yeah. I was thinking that would run parallel to this conversation with Michael, and you would have been like, yeah, this is like what I want to get into.
Yeah, you know, the thing about that is I realized I know nothing about MLPs or these CEFs, and I realized that if somebody really needs to like explain it to me for an hour and I can't figure it out myself and I just have to rely on someone else knowing better than me, that's probably not the thing I should be investing in. So for me personally, at this point in my life, I want the easiest thing possible. So I think from now on, if it's not like something I can touch, like a piece of like real estate or a property, something really, really simple like an index fund, I think I'm going to sit out for a while.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think simple is definitely better. And every time I do something new, I kind of pinch myself. I'm like, you're an idiot. You don't need to have excitement here in investing. Good investing is boring investing. But I think as we've seen markets get shaken up and
some of these platforms start to have issues. Another thing that I realized is like, I hate to lose investing, you know? And I think that's also, it's so important now more than ever to diversify. And we've seen this, Johnny, myself, Derek, we've all had losses in 2022 from investing. And it goes to show you the importance of diversifying. So I would see these as something to, I see these as something that's probably not as safe as a Vanguard index fund, but not too far off from it. Hmm. Certainly a lot more, you know, a lot safer than some of these kind of alternative platforms. But, you know, to have some in the basket there, I'm still happy with my positions in the municipal bond funds. I think I'll keep those. Maybe I'll start trading them per the recommendations of Michael, just to give that a try. But I think simple is better. That's the motto for 2023.
Yeah. I mean, who knows, right? I mean, my problem is with all my eggs in the Vanguard now, if that ever goes down or just the index fund itself goes down, I'm screwed. So who knows, right? We might look back on this and be like, Sam Marks had another home run.
Man, well, if Vanguard goes down, oh my gosh,
we're fucked. Like, seriously, if that's the company that goes down, we are screwed.
There,
like,
is no plan B.
Yeah, no. Like, I'll just throw my hands on the air and be like, all right, I'm moving to Andorra and become a sheep farmer.
Yeah, exactly. We'll just go back to like being hunters and gatherers at that point or something.
Yeah. All right. So I checked out the newsletter website, and I'm going to play the devil's advocate on this one. I have a hard time believing that he forgot what the URL was, but then the website itself is the most markety sales page I've ever seen to sign up for a newsletter.
And look at it yet. Take a look.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, unless he didn't. Yeah, cfinsider.com.
Oh, well, because it redirects to Contrarian Outlook.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Unless he just paid some marketer to write this and he never looked at it, it is in like this like giant, you know, 26-point font, you know, with like explanation marks and then like the like different size fonts, different like underlines and like, you know, different bolds. It's like, I don't know. Like, it to me, I'm like, okay, this just reads like a high pressure sales letter. And if I was running, you know, if I was running a newsletter, there's no way I would have forgot what the URL was if I had written this.
I think we should actually write our subscribe to Invest Like a Boss exactly like this.
I mean, we would get a lot more signups for sure.
Do we know how many subscribers we have? I've never been able to find that stat.
Yeah, I have no idea either. And actually, we don't mail it. We don't sell anything. Like, so
we're
doing something wrong. Like, we would make way more money. Yeah, like, I think this is why people like Invest Like a Boss, but also the reason why we don't make any money from this.
God, we need new goals. Derek, go time. Right. Check out contrarianoutlook.com for some content writing strategies.
Just go type it into chat GDP. Spin us out a newsletter.
That's a good idea. Spin us out a sign up form, a sign up newsletter. What would it be? Sign up long form blog post for our podcast.
Yeah, like an opt in. Yeah, there you go. So yeah, and at the end of it, we'll disclaim it. But like, neither Sam, Johnny, or Derek has even read this. This was just spit out by chatbot.
If you have any financial issues, blame ChatGPT.
Yeah.
Anyways, that was fun. I learned quite a bit. It was a good rehash, I think, on CEFs. If you guys want to check out the previous episodes that Michael Foster, the quote-unquote CEF professor, he joined us in episode 63 on a guest-hosted episode with him and Brett Owens. That was on CEFs. And episode 68 was actually a really fun episode on municipal bonds, and we were driving around in a limo. We actually recorded in a limo, so that was good fun. We discussed municipal bonds, and pretty shortly after, when I got in my positions in those. So check out those episodes. Hopefully, you guys enjoyed this and learned a little something on CEFs. If you make any investments in CEFs, give us a shout either in the Boss Lounge, Patreon, or in the new Patreon Discord group, which we are all much more active in these days, and it's gaining a lot of traction.
Yeah, so if you're enjoying that, just join the Patreon and you'll get an invite there, and see you guys in the next episode.
Thanks for listening to the Invest Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.